The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
If you're listening in the Northern Hemisphere, now in the middle of January, I wonder if, like me, you're bedeviled by thoughts of bright yellow light, blue skies, the smell of cut grass, the sound of a bustling beach, or the simple joy of a warm breeze on your skin. Hello, and welcome back to Science Weekly, with me, Kevin Fong. This week, we dedicate the podcast to the real star of the show, the centre of our planetary system. You guessed it, the Sun.
And I asked the librarian for a book on stars. She gave me a funny kind of picture book with portraits of men and women with names like Veronica Lake and Alan Ladd. I explained that wasn't what I wanted at all. And for some reason then obscure to me, she smiled and got me another book, the right kind of book. I was so excited to know the answer that I opened the book breathlessly right there in the library. And the book said something astonishing, a very big thought. Stars, it said, were suns, but very far away. The sun was a star, but close up.
In the spirit of the great Carl Sagan, this week we'll be discussing the incredible power of the sun and why science is still unlocking its many secrets, and why understanding the sun is the key to sustaining life on Earth in the future, up to a point, of course. Also this week, experts in solar weather have revealed that the sun's activity has gone eerily quiet. Joining me to discuss the big bright ball in the sky are two solar devotees.
I'm Lucy Green, I'm a space scientist at UCL, and my specialist subject is the sun.
I'm Helen Arney, I'm a geek songstress, and I am an enormous fan of our closest, most famous star.
But first, for Science Weekly, Natalie Starkey spoke to Dr. James McLaughlin from Northumbria University, whose life in science is dedicated to the study of magnetohydrodynamics, or MHD. What, you may ask, is that? Over to James.
Magnetohydrodynamics, it literally means magnetic fluid dynamics. It's a unification of magnetism, so electromagnetism, that's Maxwell's equations, and fluid dynamics, or hydrodynamics, and that's essentially the Navier-Stokes equation.
Okay, well, that's not much clearer, but we'll hear from Lucy later on the fundamentals of MHD, but back to Natalie and James.
It's our closest star, and it's the powerhouse of our solar system. Just talking about the anatomy of the sun, we start in the core. Essentially sort of the 30% of the radius right at the core, and that's a nuclear fusion process, and that generates vast amounts of heat, and the temperature is about 16 million degrees Kelvin. As you move out, the energy process changes to what's called the radiative zone, where radiation is the dominant energy transport mechanism, and the temperature decreases, so that's about 8 million degrees Kelvin. And then as you move out, sort of closer to the solar surface, again, the energy transport mechanism changes to convection, and that's where you have a convection zone. And again, the temperature decreases, as you would expect, we're moving away from a very hot core. Then we go out and we reach a certain layer, which we call the photosphere. That's the visible surface of the sun. And this is where light can escape the sun's gravitational pull and escape out into space. And that's what we call the photosphere. And again, that's cooler. So that has a temperature of thousands of degrees Kelvin, so 5,800 degrees Kelvin. And then you move up through the solar atmosphere, and you reach a layer called the chromosphere. And as you might expect, the temperature is very, very slightly lower. But then a very, very bizarre thing happens, and the temperature actually increases. So the temperature races up close again to a million degrees. And this is a very, very non-intuitive thing. So you can think of the very, very hot core as, say, a campfire. And as you move away, as you move away from the core, naturally it gets colder, and naturally the temperature decreases, and then you pass through the different layers, so the convection zone, and then you get to the photosphere. And then at a certain distance away from that campfire, the temperature rockets, and the temperature goes up, so really, really bizarre. So you're walking away from this campfire, as you might expect, you're getting cooler and cooler, and then you reach a hotspot, and the temperature rockets through, rockets up to millions of degrees, so comparable to the interior of the sun. And then in the solar atmosphere, as you go out to the outermost layer, there's the solar corona, and again, that has temperatures sort of 1 to 5, 1 to 10 million degrees Kelvin. So really, really, really hot. So the sun, and by extension, all stars, have very, very hot atmospheres. So the atmosphere is hotter than the solar surface, even though the energy generation mechanism appears to occur at the core. And that's a bizarre key problem in astrophysics, and it's become known as the coronal heating problem. The sun is made up of very hot gas, ionized gas called plasma, and it's threaded by a very strong magnetic field, and churning motions deep beneath the solar surface twist up and wrap up that field, bring it to the surface in a process called magnetic flux emergence. But there's a downside as well, that all that wrapping and twisting can wrap up the magnetic field, and it can break, a lot like an elastic band that's been pulled too tight.
So what does it mean when you say that the sun is breaking up? What happens? What does that mean?
Well, magnetic fields, you can think of them a bit like elastic bands, and you can pull them and you can stretch them, and they can store energy, but they can snap and they reconnect in a process called magnetic reconnection. And that process releases a lot of energy, stored magnetic potential energy, and it releases it in two ways: heat and movement waves.
And this, we're talking, what, solar flares in this sense? I've vaguely heard of these. Is this something that it happens when these things break, or have I got this the wrong end of the stick here?
No, you're right. So the magnetic field, which permeates the whole of the sun, wraps up and can break, and it sort of reorders itself. It changes its connectivity, and it releases energy. So it releases that stored, twisted energy. And a solar flare is where the energy is primarily released in radiation, but there are other manifestations of that release.
Okay, and I've heard about sunspots. Are they the same as solar flares, or are they different?
They're different to solar flares, but they're again based on that magnetic field. So the sun has a very, very strong magnetic field, and that magnetic field bursts through the solar surface and arcs round and delves beneath the solar surface, forming essentially sort of rainbows or arches. When that field twists too much and breaks, that's when you get a solar flare. But when you have a sort of very strong eruption of magnetic field through the surface, that's what causes a sunspot. So it's a region of very intense magnetic field.
And you get more of those when you've got more solar activity.
Yes, so you get more of those at solar maximum.
Okay, so we've got solar flares, and then I believe there's coronal mass ejections as well. These are two very related things, but I believe it's the coronal mass ejections are the bits that are travelling through space.
That's right. So the magnetic field gets twisted up. At some point it breaks, so more technically it reconnects, and it releases that stored energy. And simply put, it can release it in two main ways. It can dump all that energy into radiation, and that's primarily what's called a solar flare, a huge burst of light. Or it can put that energy into moving material and lifting up part of the solar atmosphere. And that's what's been called a coronal mass ejection, or a solar ejection. And these sort of large balls of plasma and material and magnetic field are thrown off into space. So there's an actual sort of physical movement of material. And sometimes they come towards Earth, and that's what's known as a halo CME.
Lucy, James described the inner workings of the sun and its enormous power, but can you pick that up and describe what a halo CME is and why it's so important for us here on Earth?
A halo CME refers to something that we see in our telescopes, and it happens, or it's formed, when we have an eruption from the sun, a coronal mass ejection or CME, that's headed right for us. In our telescopes, they form a white sort of fuzzy haze that encircles the sun. And that's the observation that tells us it's on a beeline straight for us. And the reason we're interested is because if one of these eruptions hits us, it first slams into the Earth's magnetic field, and then it can set up this series of consequences that ultimately propagate down through the upper atmosphere and down to the surface of the Earth that can produce effects. So, for example, problems with our electricity networks is the big one. So a halo CME is the warning sign from the sun that the Earth might be in trouble.
And when you talk about these solar flares hitting us, what actually is hitting us? Are we talking about bits of the sun? And if so, what are those bits?
They are bits of the sun. So it's the coronal mass ejections rather than the solar flares that are important. So the solar flare is a flash of light that we see happening in the sun's atmosphere. But sometimes when there's a big solar flare, you also have a portion of the sun's atmosphere that detaches itself. So the sun's atmosphere is made of plasma, electrically charged gas, but it also has a magnetic field threaded through it. And what's incredible about the sun is that the magnetic field is dynamic. It's not like the Earth's. And portions suddenly erupt into the solar system. And they do so with huge speeds. I think the fastest eruption I've seen headed out into the solar system with speeds of around 2,000 kilometres a second. They carry vast amounts of mass as well as magnetic field. I think what we normally say is the same mass as Mount Everest. And also, these events are colossal. They're absolutely huge. You know, much, much bigger than the sun itself. And the sun is already as wide as 109 Earths lined up side by side. So this absolutely vast, fast-moving, massive cloud just propagates out into the solar system, and poor tiny little Earth can sometimes be right in its path.
But you talk about all of that energy and all of that great velocity. Why doesn't this cause more direct physical damage to Earth?
Well, we're lucky in some senses that we have two layers of protection. The first one is the Earth's atmosphere. So that would provide a blanket to high energy particles that do make their way in. But the most important one really is our magnetic field. So any material, any charged particles or magnetic field that comes from the sun first impacts our magnetic field. So thank goodness we have one. If we didn't, we might end up like the planet Mars. So Mars has a very weak and patchy magnetic field. And as a consequence, it has a very thin atmosphere because the sun has just been scraping it away for 4,500 billion years or however long it's been that Mars has lost its magnetic field. So we are incredibly lucky to have a magnetic shield, but it is a leaky shield. And sometimes these solar eruptions punch their way in. And this is the interesting aspect, I think. So it all comes down to magnetic fields. I always talk about magnetic fields. And magnetic fields have a direction as well as a strength. And so when these coronal mass ejections from the sun reach us at the Earth, the magnetic field they carry with them, it's important to look at the structure, because some of them will impact us and actually do nothing more than just squashing our magnetic field, the Earth's magnetic field. But sometimes, if the magnetic orientation is right, it will open it up, and it's a bit like, I don't know.
It's like polarised sunglasses, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You need to take into account the direction of these fields. So if the direction is right, and we can measure that by looking at our spacecraft and getting the information back from our satellites that are in between us and the sun, and if we see that the direction of the magnetic field in the coronal mass ejection is right, then we know that it might start to open up the Earth's magnetic field, a bit like sort of peeling back the skin of a banana.
And we're describing here a very angry, violent sun, but actually, at the moment, what's curious about the sun is how quiescent it is, isn't it? It's quite quiet at the moment, I understand.
The sun never fails to keep us on our toes. So you're absolutely right. The sun is both active and inactive. And by that, I mean we need to consider different timescales. So the sun has an activity cycle that lasts roughly 11 years, and the number of coronal mass ejections and flares rises and falls over that time. So we are at solar maximum for that cycle. But we predicted quite a large solar maximum. And in the recent years, we've had to reduce our expectations of how active the sun's going to be. And actually, we're kind of at this mini maximum, is what people are calling it. So the previous solar cycles have just been getting smaller and smaller.
Over what period of time?
So over the last sort of couple of decades, three decades. It just seems to be, I think, that in the run-up to the space age and during the early days of the space age, we had a very active sun. And, you know, what do? We look at the sun, we characterise it, and we think, OK, well, this is standard for the sun. But actually, the sun has been there for 4,500 million years doing its own thing. And we shouldn't just base what we see during our lifetime on or impose that on the sun. And yes, it seems to be that we are coming out of a maximum phase of activity of the sun. And in the coming years, decades, the sun's activity will be declining.
And when you say activity, we're talking about cooling of its reduction in the overall radiative output of this object.
There's many ways to measure the activity levels, you're right. So it could be the amount of visible light the sun gives off, and that doesn't vary by too much. It could be the amount of ultraviolet or X-rays that the sun gives off, and that does vary by many orders of magnitude. And this is another exciting area of research. What are the consequences of a big drop in ultraviolet light coming from the sun on the Earth's atmosphere? What changes happen? You know, what's the chemistry? And this is where I sort of, you know, I have to hand over to other people to really answer those questions. But the sun affects us in very complex ways that we don't fully understand.
How wrong could our models of the sun be? Because I remember studying this and sitting there and looking at pages and pages of these equations to describe the internal machinery of the sun. And then eventually realising we had to guess. We can't see into the centre of the sun. So to what extent might your models be completely wrong?
Do I publicly say that we don't really understand? I don't know. But you're right, we can't see into the sun, inside the sun, and that's where all the important action happens. I already talked about magnetic fields. They are created or maintained and amplified inside the sun. The solar cycle is influenced by processes that happen inside the sun.
That we don't fully understand.
No.
We don't really understand why there is that cycle of activity.
Not in any deep way. So we understand broadly how a cycle might play out. And we understand broadly that the fluid flows of the electrically charged gas of the sun amplify and evolve its magnetic field. And we can sort of put a kind of cartoon to how that happens. But the really physical understanding is not there. And that's because we lack... Okay, we still got to do a lot of research, but we also need more observations of what's happening inside the sun. But, I mean, we've said you can't see inside the sun, but what's interesting is that you can listen to the sun. So the sun has sound waves that propagate around the inside. So whilst we use electromagnetic radiation to probe the atmosphere of the sun, we use sound waves to probe the interior. And there's a lot of great work being done in that area, in Britain, in particular at Birmingham University.
Yeah, I mean, I think it took me a little while to appreciate, because in all your childhood science books, you've always got that picture of the sun that's got a big slice cut out of it, it's a 3D cake, and, you know, a big glowy bit in the middle and then some slightly less orangey bits as you go outside. That, you know, that's just artists' impression of stuff that's built out of equations that we've interpolated from sunshine, really.
Absolutely. Everything we learn is carried in sunshine. That is the messenger of the sun. I should say that we have theoretical models of the sun. So we know how big it is, we know how massive it is, and we know how much light it's giving off. And you can use that to then sort of backtrack. Okay, we know the sun's made of a hydrogen gas. And to get a stable sun emitting the amount of energy that we see, you can then construct the internal structure of the sun. And then we use the observations of the sound waves inside the sun to sort of back that up and refine it and so on. But I think we have a pretty good understanding of the structure. So when you see the cutaway and you see the core and you see the different zones, I think that's well understood. But the details of the plasma flow, the electrically charged gas, how it flows, that's what you need to know to understand how the solar cycle works. For example, we have no idea why the solar cycle lasts roughly 11 years. Why is that? I have no idea. Why is it not 5, 100, 1,000? It must be to do with these flows, but we can't see them well enough yet.
And in the existing models, is there a limit to how long this decline in activity could go on for?
Well, there is speculation that it could play out over the coming decades. But again, it's such a difficult process to predict the upcoming solar cycles because we don't have that physical model. It's based on statistics of previous cycles. And without the physical model, we won't truly be able to say confidently, this is how long it's going to last.
Given the short period during which we've been able to observe the sun and we've been trying to understand it, which is really, in terms of advanced remote sensing, it's decades, really. Are you telling me that it's all a little bit like as if you'd just been cast into existence on Christmas morning and you said, oh, well, this is how a day works. Everyone rolls downstairs and opens up lots of presents, so every day is like this. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, I think so. I think the sun has so many interesting aspects to it. So many science areas come together in understanding the sun. And you kind of, well, I certainly found myself getting completely captivated by particular aspects. And I think we have to be careful not to assume that what we've seen defines the sun, and that we need to be open-minded, that actually I think we have to be careful, yes, not to sort of superimpose our preconceptions that we've had just for a small number of decades on what the future of solar physics might be. And it's absolutely fascinating to see the sun changing in unexpected ways. It's forcing us to be open-minded.
Slightly worrying for me. Helen, I'm reassured about the constancy of the sun there? I'm not.
Yes, not particularly, because the other thing I heard the other week is that the Met Office are now producing solar weather reports for exactly this reason, that international bodies are concerned about the point that we might be hit by a huge amount of energy, which has happened before. You were telling me about this the other day, a pre-electronic age coronal mass ejection hit Earth and knocked out telegraph wires. And I cannot imagine what impact that would have now, but it would be catastrophic. So is that why people are so worried? They're expecting something like this to happen?
We think it could happen any time. You're absolutely right. So the event that is the poster child of solar activity was one that happened in 1859. And it's become called the Carrington event after the brewer / astronomer who was observing the sun at that time.
Brewer/astronomer. That is a job and a half.
I know, back in the days when, you know, privately funded science happened. So, yes, his family was, family money came from brewing, but he was out, his fascination was to draw sunspots. That was the sort of height of science at the time, when you're both a scientist, a brewer and an artist. And he noticed this flash of light in a sunspot group on the sun. And then 17 hours later, the world erupted in the most amazing display of the Northern Lights, and the telegraph operators were able to operate their telegraph lines without any batteries. They had electric shocks. Fires started up as these electric shocks discharged and went out in the offices. And you're absolutely right. That is the big event that happened in the past. And it's used as a sort of benchmark of what could we have today if an equivalent event reached the Earth. And there was a report in the US that showed potentially the damage to satellites, loss of GPS, electricity networks failing as transformers fail, could globally amount to over $2 trillion. And that really made people sort of sit up and pay attention that, yes, we need to we need to try and predict what the sun's going to do, but we need to monitor what it's doing all the time. And so in America, they do that a lot. Well, they have been doing it for years. And in the UK, it got taken seriously when it was added to the National Risk Register. So space weather, the sun-earth interaction. And the Met Office are and will be doing our space weather forecasts as well as our weather forecasts. So I'm hoping that, you know, at the end of the news in the coming years, you might be able to get your weather forecast and then you're well. And tonight, the chance of aurora is 5% if you're above certain latitudes. And you know, wouldn't that be fab?
Thank you, Lucy. Fascinating stuff. Now on to Helen and a bit of a musical rendition. Your ode to the sun, Helen?
Well, yes, I have written a song about the sun, which is something that I was asked to do when I was asked to write something topical about science. And the thing about trying to write something topical about science is that it's both really easy and really hard. It's really easy because, like, there's loads of science going on all the time. But it's really hard because, you know, how do you choose something topical? And the moment I was asked to write this song, something really bizarre did happen, which was a big Class X CME, a big coronal mass ejection. I actually spoke to Lucy Green sitting here at the time, and I said, well, what is this about? Is this something to do with the sun and this 11-year cycle? And she explained to me all the stuff that she's just explained right now. But at that point, to be honest, I wasn't really listening because I'd already made up my own mind because I'm a bit of a theoretician and I come up with my own theories. And my theory is that because certain floppy-haired Mancunian physics professors have been pointing at other parts of the universe, our own local sun, our most famous star, has got its huff on.
Sorry, I didn't quite get that. Who were you talking about?
Kevin, if you grow your hair and change your accent, you'll understand. I used to be someone. Now I'm just another sun, one of 100,000,000,000,000,000,000. You treat me insignificantly. You name a tabloid after me. Synonymous with paparazzi. Just a backdrop for Brian Cox on TV. Oh, look at that star. Since Edwin Hubble, it's never been the same. Those pictures of other stars pushed me out of the frame. You never even gave me a proper name, something like Alpha Centauri or Epsilon Tauri or Delta Libre or maybe HR2948 or Kevin. You've achieved nuclear fusion. Oh, well done. Made some helium from a little hydrogen. That's very cute, Earth. But every second I'll do that with 600 million tons. If I was Marilyn Monroe, you'd be the one I can't remember the name of from One Direction, which is all of One Direction. You should have stopped at Copernicus. Then I'd still be the center of your universe. You say I'm just an average ball of gas. I say you're talking out of Uranus. Now, I'm not sure I've pronounced that right, but I'm sure one of you can correct me. 1.4 million kilometers. That's my diameter. Tell me seriously, with those parameters, have you ever tried to put a hat on there? Hip, 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 hooray. Well, I'll be a red giant someday, and your world will go up in flames. Ah, I shouldn't laugh. Ah, but in the meantime, please join my Facebook fan page. Seriously, it'd be really nice if you could lock on and give me a like, because I've only got 9 likes. Well, now it's gone down to 8 because Pluto defriended me.
Fantastic. Do you know, although depressingly, I've realised I could never be a star because you can't have a star called Kevin. You could probably have one called Helen. You could probably have one called Lucy. Those are names that do start, but, you know, that one's Kevin. It doesn't work, does it?
The star in my song is called Kevin. I've decided.
Are you going to take that on tour and always use that?
We did it on our tour in 2012, and every night the star was called Kevin. And
I'm loving it.
I have to thank Lucy Green as well, because she did actually fact check that song for me and gave me the reassurance I needed to make sure that it was a peer-reviewed song. So that is one of the only peer-reviewed comedy songs around. And it has actually been used as an educational tool. I've been told by many teachers.
I'm loving it. My public outreach to schools, Star Called Kevin, which should be the new name of the song. You've taken that on tour with the Festival of the Spoken Nerd. Is it going on tour again?
We are about to embark on another tour. 27 dates all around the country, everywhere from Sheffield and Durham to Maidenhead and Brighton Science Festival. We're going all over the place. We do some fun stuff like that. We start a fire in a bin and I smash a glass with the power of my voice.
That sounds frightening.
It sounds a lot worse than it sounds. Yeah, it's actually really, it's quite hard to do. I do have the help of a massive amplifier, but genuinely every night I do smash a glass purely with the sound of my voice. It does not sound good, but it looks amazing.
Brilliant. Well, I still have mixed feelings about the way you make fun of the name Kevin there, but we'll leave that for now.
Eder construction is underway. 2 years were necessary to prepare the 42-hectare Eder platform. In August 2010, work began on the first buildings. Another 8 years will be required to complete the scientific installation and to assemble, test and commission the Eder device. Eder is one of the largest engineering and construction projects in Europe today. The seismic foundations are in place.
Not only are we getting better at harnessing the energy of the sun with solar energy technology, the processes that dry the sun are being emulated here on Earth. And the most ambitious experiment underway is the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor, being constructed as we speak in southern France. ISA is an experimental machine as ambitious as the LHC. And the man with the job to explain ITER to the world is Dr. Michel Clesson. Welcome to Science Weekly, Michel. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the nuclear processes that happen in the sun and why we always talk about this being like a star on Earth.
Yeah, as you know, the reactions that take place in the sun and in the stars are fusion reactions, that is, contrary to fission of heavy nuclei. Light atoms like hydrogen, helium, etc., in certain conditions, essentially high temperature and high densities, they will fuse, they will merge to give heavier atom, and this reaction liberates a quite high amount of energy. This is the basic physics principles that apply in the stars.
And so we're talking about getting atoms to come together and fuse, as opposed to splitting the atom.
Exactly.
The so-called fission. So fusion rather than fission. How much extra energy do you get out of this process of fusion compared with the fission?
Quite high amount of energy. A fusion between deuterium and tritium nuclei, so the isotopes of hydrogen, generates 14 mega electron volt of energy, which is rather high. We used to say that 1 gram of hydrogen in a fusion reactor generates as much energy as 8,000 tons of oil.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
Yes.
But what are the challenges? I mean, why this seems such an obvious source of energy? What's been the challenge thus far? What are you exploring? What are you trying to do to make this a reality?
A reality on Earth, that's the main challenge. The main difficulty is that we have to reach very high temperature. So we have to confine a gas, hydrogen gas, heated up to 100, 150 million degrees. We have to confine this gas in a physical vessel, which requires, this is the tokamak approach of fusion. There are other approaches, but in a tokamak, so in a reactor like ITER, The vessel in which the gas is confined and heated is surrounded by powerful magnets, big magnets, that will generate a sort of magnetic bottle, which will prevent the particles to touch the walls of the reactor.
And presumably that's because at that temperature, if any part of that plasma touched the walls, it would just destroy the vessel.
It will destroy the vessel and also immediately cool down the gas, the plasma, so that the reactions will stop immediately. That's the main. That's also one of the difficulties of fusion, is to sustain, to maintain this plasma at a high temperature for several minutes.
And can you just explain to me how you're heating it to that temperature? I mean, it's an enormous temperature. What process is it that heats up the gas in the first place?
There are three technologies that are used and that will be used in ITER. The first heating comes from the magnets will drive an electric current within the gas, and this, by ohmic resistance, will heat the gas. to a certain temperature. But that's not enough. After that, there will be several generators of microwave radiation. So it's about the same technology as we have in our kitchen, but a little bit bigger. This microwave generator are 1 meter high and nearly 2 meters long. But that's not enough. And then the third technology will be the injection in the gas of neutral particles, essentially pellets of deuterium, frozen deuterium. And this will, by the collisions with the particles, again provide a further heating.
And all of this together is going to heat this plasma up to this massive temperature and hopefully get you a sustainable quantity of plasma. It sounds pretty labor-intensive. Is the energy that you're putting into heating it up equal to what you get out or greater?
Yeah, that's a good question. And this is really the challenge of ITER because up to now, the existing tokamaks in the world, and you probably know that the most performant tokamak in the world is in the UK, close to Oxford. This is the JET, so a European facility. They have almost reached the break-even point. That is, they almost generated as much energy as they've injected in the machine, but not quite. So the ratio was 0.7. So, but they were quite close to this break-even point. In ITER, according to my colleagues' estimate, we will generate about 500 megawatt of thermal power, compared to 50 megawatt which will be injected in the machine. So that the ratio in ITER should be around 10.
You're not even just aiming for break even. You're aiming for a 10 times return on your invested energy.
That's the objective. If we reach this 10 factor, we will be able to say that ITER is a success.
You'll be able to say nuclear fusion is a success, will you not?
Yeah, of course, yes.
If I had to ask you if you were a betting man, when we might hope to have commercial fusion, when would you say?
In the recent conferences that I've attended, people give the figure of 2050.
Wow, that's pretty close. I mean, I 2050. Okay.
2040. Most of the ITER members. So you know that ITER is supported by 7 members, which are the big countries or big group of countries. So Europe, China, India, Russia, Japan, Korea, and United States. They all have plans to start the next generation reactor, which will be a little bit bigger than ITER, and the schedule is around 2040-43 for most of these countries. So at some stage you can consider that this will be the start of commercial reactors if everything goes well. China would like to speed up all this, and they may take a decision to build in China a Chinese ITER. So they would like to accelerate the development of this new technology.
Helen.
Surely this is something that the sustainable energy lobby should be jumping on and really getting behind. But are there some environmental downsides to scaling this up so this becomes something that every country does? For instance, where does the fuel come from? And as we all know with nuclear fission, what do you do with any waste products that come out the other end? Are these things sort of holding back the environmental lobby from really getting behind you?
Fusion is essentially a green technology, so no greenhouse gas production, of course. And as far as the waste are concerned, ITER will produce very limited amounts of radioactive waste, and definitely no long life radioactive waste. It has been demonstrated that after 100 years here, the radioactivity in the reactor will have disappeared.
Michelle, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm rather excited about a future in which fusion may be the way forwards. Good luck with all your work. I'll follow it with great interest.
Thank you for your interest. Yes.
I mean, I don't know about you, I was kind of surprised that he was quoting the middle of the 21st century as the time when we might see commercial fusion. What do you guys think?
I was thinking that it takes years to build this facility. So you've got to have the build, the material development, and the success of the project. And that, I mean, that's going to take many, many years. So 2050 to me seemed like a really short timescale to actually have this happening as a commercially viable source of electricity or source of energy.
But like all of things, surely there's a certain amount of Moore's law will apply to this, that as soon as they start working on it and they get a certain amount working and they discover certain things, the other bits of technology that they've been waiting on will catch up with that, and suddenly things will become easier and faster. And is something like that going to apply to this in the way that it applied to computing power, in a way that it has applied to other projects?
Well, I guess one hopes. The only worry for me is I still am not quite around the material science that's needed here, because the scaling up of the energy in and energy out, he seems reasonably confident about. But these containers are quite hard to build, and they're taking massive fluxes of neutrons through them, become quite brittle as a result, and I'm not entirely sure that they are all over that just yet. And I'm wondering whether that will be the bottleneck in it. I'm unclear where the real bottleneck will be in this whole thing. But it would be remarkable to think, wouldn't it, of a 21st century in which there was a proliferation of fusion reactors around the world. It would change everything forever.
It would. This is the clean energy that we've been wanting for decades. I mean, as soon as we figured out that fusion was happening inside stars, that opened up the prospect, seriously opened up the prospect. We understand the science, and now it's a technological question, a technological challenge to make it happen on Earth.
And actually, now that you mention that, explain to me how the sun manages to do the containment of the fusion, because, here we have to use massive magnetic fields to stop this stuff escaping. How does the sun do it?
Oh, the sun just does it so easily. Gravity. The sun uses gravity. I mean, it's such a massive ball of gas that at the centre you have very high pressures and very high densities, and that's what's containing this, essentially a huge nuclear bomb, but it's contained by the overlying layers of gas. So it's only sort of the central 25% of the sun where nuclear fusion is happening, and then the outer layers is where the energy has to trickle through to get out. So in the temperature of the sun, in the centre of the sun, you have a temperature of 15 million Kelvin, and you have a density that's like 10 times the density of lead. So the pressures in there are billions of times the atmospheric pressure around us. And under those conditions, you can both create these fusion reactions, but also sustain them. I don't want to say a manageable process, but it's not just releasing the energy all at once. It's keeping it ongoing and ongoing and ongoing.
So the thing that frustrates me whenever I hear people like Michelle speak is that they're quite optimistic. They talk about a timeline that's laid out in decades towards a future progress. They tell you that the technology scales and that a lot of the problems are foreseeable. And when I hear him say that, you just ask yourself why there isn't more resource. And when I say more resource, they do quite well compared to other science projects and engineering projects. But I'm talking about sort of Manhattan Project level scale, the sorts of things in which are significant fractions of a country or country's GDP over a significant fraction of a decade. Because we know that wherever it's been an engineering problem in the past and you brute force it, you get a long way in a short space of time. Look at Manhattan Project, look at Apollo. So why is there not a Manhattan Project level effort into fusion? I mean, do you not feel the same?
Well, I think that's a very noble way to view it, that yes, if you pooled your resources, you can make amazing and expensive things happen. But at the same time, a reliable energy source is so vital to modern society that there would be massive risks, surely, associated to having one centralised project upon which many, many countries are relying. We're always talking in this country about not relying on energy being, you know, sent in from France or wherever. We want to be able to sustain ourselves. So this kind of goes against that strategy.
Yeah, although I suppose the energy security problem could hardly be any worse than it is at the present time. And I mean, I've heard people talk about, you know, the way to do it, of course, is to develop the enabling technology and then do what you did with GPS, which is give it away to everybody so that everybody has it. And I just feel, I guess, a little frustrated, because if this is as scalable as it sounds, if it is in the main an engineering problem, and our politicians continue to say, yes, we believe that climate change is a problem, we believe in the need to take this seriously, well, really, to show that you take it seriously, a huge investment in this would probably be one of those ways.
Yeah. Are they concerned they're going to back the wrong horse? They're going to spend all the money on Blu-ray when really DVDs were absolutely fine. I don't know. Maybe a better DVD is an option instead of going for it. I don't know. I agree with Lucy that the finding many different solutions to the energy problem is perhaps a better policy than choosing one thing. But, you know, throwing more money at the problem as a whole is surely going to help.
Well, let's finish with a slightly simpler question. You know, part of the reason for making this programme is because in the depths of January, I'm missing the sun. And this time of year, every year, I kind of want to go somewhere that sees it more. How do you guys feel about that?
I would love to have a little bit more sunshine. I've been doing a lot of events outdoors on open air stages for Stargazing Live last week. So I have enormous sympathy with every amateur astronomer out there looking at the sky in the freezing cold January. Yes, it would be nice to have a little bit of sunshine relief during the day as well.
Oh, I don't know. Every day is a sunny day for me.
Because you're looking at it through a satellite. That's fair.
When I yearn for more sun, which I do, I yearn to get closer to the sun and I want to see more of it. I want to receive more sunlight on my satellites. And I guess that's a kind of a cheesy way to say that I'm excited about a mission that's coming up called Solar Orbiter that we're building at the moment. And that's going to get so close to the sun, it'll be inside the orbit of Mercury. So I yearn for more sun, but I yearn for the science that will give me.
Yeah. I'm altogether a much less sophisticated person. I just want to go on a Caribbean cruise, to be honest. Thank you guys for coming in and joining me today and for your great insight, Lucy, and for your fantastic ukulele playing. I'm going to have to get me one of those, I think. Thank you.
You can't have mine.
I thought that was the deal.
No!
That's all we have time for this week. Again, a huge thanks to all my guests and contributors, Dr. James McLaughlin, Natalie Starkey, Michelle Cassens, Helen Arney and Lucy Green. We'll have links to all our contributors on the blog for this edition of the podcast. Remember, for breaking science news in sunshine or under the night sky, just go to theguardian.com/science. I'm Kevin Fong, and Science Weekly is produced by Jason Phipps. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.